You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of September 2020 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Monocle's headquarters here in Zurich. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up, job losses, grounded fleets and unprecedented turbulence. We'll ask the aviation trade body IATA whether the industry can bounce back. Also ahead, Monocle's Alexei Kolyarov examines the significance of next month's municipal elections in the Austrian capital.
The Social Democratic Party, which has ruled Vienna since 1945, is widely expected to remain in power. Like Austria's other big parties, it has always ignored the problem of the disenfranchised.
Plus, we'll be heading to the Swiss capital, Bern, to digest the outcome of a series of national votes on everything from the EU to fighter jets. And then...
I'm Chiara Rimella, Monocle's culture editor, and today I'll be talking about what the future holds for experiential art and the birth of a new broadcaster in Britain.
Grazie, Chiara. All that right here in The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé. And good afternoon from a very sunny Zurich. It's a bit of a Middle Europa Monday. We're going to start in Geneva, where, of course, the coronavirus pandemic has hammered global businesses, but arguably none has been more adversely affected than the aviation industry. A recent report suggests around 500,000 airline jobs could be lost by December in what is considered to be the worst crisis facing the industry since 9/11. Well, I'm joined on the line from Geneva now by Chris Goeter from the International Air Transport Association, IATA. Chris, good afternoon. Just, I'm wondering what type of scenarios IATA has been running, or was there something sitting on the books that you were able to pull out of a drawer to say, if something like this came along, this is what the industry needs to do?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tyler, and thanks for having me on. Look, the situation is unprecedented. We've never had a shutdown of aviation at this magnitude before. I mean, we've seen the short-term impacts of things like, a decade ago, there was the ash cloud, you might remember, in Europe, which grounded flights, but that was for, a week, 2 weeks? This has been months now. And, we've progressively put out sort of prognostications for what we think will happen with traffic and jobs and economic development as a result of this. And every time we revisit the numbers, it keeps getting worse, unfortunately, because governments have not found a way to restart air transport. So that's really what we need to have as soon as possible, is a plan for restarting international traffic, because until that happens, these impacts are going to keep getting worse.
You're sitting in the home of multilateralism in Geneva. Where are these conversations occurring? Because, of course, there has to be one conversation on the part of airlines within national borders, and I guess crossing borders as well, to talk about the issues of quarantines and closed borders. Obviously, this is a huge issue. Airlines are all about planning. People like to know that their 9 o'clock flight is going to go on the 23rd of October, like it says it is. So that's obviously one component of it. And then, of course, there are myriad other issues around this. So what type of role is IATA playing amidst all of this right now?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's an international business, and it's no use just having kind of unilateral decisions being taken by governments. Governments have to work together. And the first stage for that is the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. They're based in Montreal. They're the UN body that has the representatives of all the main countries sitting there. And we have worked with that body to come up with what we call takeoff guidelines. So those were first issued earlier in the year and looked at issues around public health, the wearing of masks on board, sanitization of aircraft, and so on. And that's been broadly very successful and has been adopted by many countries. So that was a good format and a good forum for moving forward. We're now working with the same body on looking at how we can restart. And the key issue for us is testing. We think that if you can test passengers for COVID-19 before takeoff, you can give governments that confidence that the people that we are carrying around the world are not infected with COVID-19 and therefore can be allowed into the country without the need for quarantine, because it's quarantine measures that is killing the demand for air transport. So that's what we need to tackle. So ICAO is really the first organization. And then from there, we're working with regional bodies, such as, for example, in the EU, to kind of harmonize that approach. So that's really where we need to make the difference.
Are you seeing any hopefully lights on the runway? We shouldn't use a tunnel analogy at this point, that are at least going to guide you to better skies right now, and whether that is a more joined up EU, as you mentioned, or are we seeing potentially some more aligned thinking within Asia? Of course, we've seen a bit of a restart between Singapore and Japan recently. Where can we look to for examples at the moment, do you think?
You're right that there are some travel corridors or travel bubbles that have been proposed, and we would support that approach as a first step. If that can prove the concept works, then hopefully that gives, as I say, governments that confidence they can open up. So whether that's in Asia, as you mentioned, or in the transatlantic routes, there are a number of pilots' ideas that are being brought forward. I think one of the key changes in recent weeks has been the imminent development of a test for COVID-19 that can meet some of the criteria we've established. I think it's very important that a test is obviously reliable, quick to administer, doesn't require doctors and nurses. It can be administered by someone without medical training, that's relatively cheap, gives a result quickly. So those kind of test technologies were not so easily found recently, but now we think that is a possibility, and that does make a game changer for us. We think then it becomes possible to test on a mass scale. Obviously, the first priority must be the medical profession, but after that, we think that air passengers should be up there in the list of people able to receive these tests. And that, I think, gives us the basis to go to governments and say, look, there's no reason not to trial this now. We can move forward.
Chris, we've been hearing out of China anyway that they're talking about a bounce back, domestic that is, we have to caveat that, but domestic travel is reaching levels 80%, maybe a little higher. Some are even saying that internal traffic is even flat from where it was pre-COVID. Now, of course, maybe we have to take a little bit of that with a grain of salt. Is there anything to learn from China right now in terms of I guess you're talking about sort of hygiene measures on board. Anything that is there or elsewhere in Asia for that matter?
I would say that, you're right that domestic travel has recovered up to a point. What we saw was a bounce back in domestic travel, but that then sort of flatlined. So when we look at our figures, the overall numbers for July, we're about to put out our August stats, but that's not for another day or two. But the July stats showed that overall traffic was still almost 80% down. And for international traffic, it was over 90% down. So whilst there's some encouraging news happening domestically, it's still the picture in general is very, very grim. And we have not yet found a solution for opening up international travel, or rather governments have not yet agreed on that. So that's still our number one priority.
How much does there need to be some level of, let's say, leading by example? I've been flying around enough in Europe. Of course, it's unfortunate that airports are as empty as they are, but it's pretty much flying as we knew it before. Of course, there are mask issues on board, but in many ways, it is quite a good time to fly if you don't like long queues, etc. None of us want it that way, but actually, flying is okay. Does there need to be some type of spark as well?
Well, we've done some polling of people, and yes, you're right that there is still confidence. A lot of people want to fly given the opportunity. We saw that in the summer season where routes opened up. There was a sudden rush to visit those countries, and airlines were able to put more aircraft onto those particular routes. So they're able to respond swiftly where demand exists. And I think the overall passion of people to fly hasn't changed. There are some people who are worried about the health impacts. We've done our best to explain that aircraft are in fact very, very safe, probably safer than any other sort of public space that you might think about in terms of the way that the airflow is managed, the filters we have for filtering the air, people wearing masks, and the sanitation measures we've put in place. That means the risk of catching COVID is very low, and people are starting to get that message. The demand is there to fly. But obviously, quarantine is the problem. No one doesn't There's no point in taking a short business trip or a weekend break for a few days if you're then going to be quarantined for 5, 10, 14 days on your return. That's simply not viable. So we do recognize that until we've dealt with the quarantine issue, demand is going to stay at a very, very low level.
Because just before we go, and on the topic of leading by example, was it quarantines? Was it something else which has also, yeah, had you put the brakes on doing your IATA conference in, was supposed to be in Amsterdam, and that was supposed to be the host country this year? Was that a big discussion with obviously many airlines saying, look, you know, it doesn't look great if we're not flying to a meeting and we're also doing it over Teams or over some video conference form. Was that a bit of a tussle? Because when you saw that, you're thinking, God, you know, again, do we need some type of leadership to actually show it is okay to fly? Or was a lot of it just around quarantines for your various delegates having to get into the EU?
I mean, that's exactly it. It's a hugely disappointing decision. I think we really wanted to have a physical meeting, and we held the decision as long as possible to see if that would be possible. It just isn't possible when you look at the international nature of our membership, and it wouldn't have been fair to kind of say, well, a lot of European guys can come, but I'm afraid it's going to be very, very difficult for anyone from the Americas or Asia or Africa or Latin America to come. That's just not the way we can run a global organization like IATA. So regretfully, we've had to move it to a virtual meeting. Nevertheless, that meeting will occur. There's a lot of really important decisions that we need to take. We will need to be sending signals out to the world that we need government support to restart. And that will be the opportunity to do that. And then hopefully, by the time we get to the middle of next year, we can return our AGM to its usual June date and have it in person with everyone there. And all the world's media and yourself as well, I hope, can come and join us at that meeting.
Chris, we'll look forward to catching up after that, of course, virtual session when it happens. Chris Goeder from IATA in Geneva. We're going over to London now. Hilding Goffin is there with today's headlines.
Thanks, Tyler. There has been heavy fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Armenia has accused Azerbaijan of air and artillery attacks and declared martial law. A top French doctor has warned that new coronavirus restrictions are needed to avoid overwhelming the country's health system. Patrick Bouet says France is running out of time to avoid a health crisis. The New York Times reports that Donald Trump paid just $750 in federal income tax in both 2016 and his first year in the White House. The US president has dismissed the claims as fake news. And the Swedish menswear brand Asket has launched a receipt which will allow customers to see the amount of water and energy used to create certain items. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Tyler.
Thanks very much, Yulia. We're going to stay in Switzerland now because voters here have overwhelmingly rejected a bid to limit the free movement of people and immigration from the European Union. The Swiss public also narrowly voted yesterday in favor of replacing the country's aging fleet of F-18 fighter jets. We're going to cross over to Bern right now. I'm happy to say that Christoph Lenz is there. He is with Tages Anzeiger and TA Media in general. He's a regular voice, or becoming a regular voice anyway, also on Monocle on Sunday. Christoph, very good to talk to you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you, Tyler?
I'm very well, thank you. Hope the same down Bern way. Let's start maybe, we'll come back to the EU in a moment, but it was interesting. We had our conference up in St. Moritz a little over 10 days ago now, and it was interesting hearing one of the people from the Ministry of Defense really sort of talking quite confidently that this part of the referendum was whether Switzerland should be buying up to 40 new fighter jets, price tag of around 6 billion Swiss francs. And everyone was talking in the world that, yeah, 60-65% of Swiss are in favor of this. And then we were on a knife edge yesterday. It was 50-50 for so long. And the vote is yes in the end, but only by 8,000 votes. Was that surprising, or were you maybe expecting it could head that way?
I wasn't at all. No, it was actually... It must have been quite shocking for the Army and the Federal Department of Defense, because this vote really came out of nowhere. We didn't expect it. All the polls were looking good for the Army. Everything seemed to be fine. The campaign was rather slow. And then out of nothing, we have this one of the closest decisions ever in Switzerland in a popular referendum. It really was on knife edge until the last county was counted, and we finally knew that it was 1.6 million votes for and 1.59 million votes against the new fighter jet. So no, it was it must be quite shocking for the army.
Just tell us quickly, what does this mean now? I had part of it unpacked to me that we should get to the new year here in Switzerland, and then we will know, of course, which of the four fighter aircraft that have been shortlisted they'll be going for. But can something else happen in the meantime now? Because it's been a long-running saga. The Gripen fighter jet from Sweden many years ago, are we talking about 6-7 years ago now, that was obviously voted down. We're back in this territory, or is it done now? This, the people have voted. Yes, it was tight, because you see in the papers this morning that, of course, those against the fighter jet are also claiming victory, or at least some type of victory as well.
That's right. I think when it comes to the question which of the four jets Switzerland is going to buy in the end, to remind you, we have the F-35 and the Super Hornet, which are both from the United States, and then there is the Eurofighter from Germany and the Rafale from France. Those are the four options. I think we still, even with a slight majority, there still is a majority to go ahead to buy the jet, and I think that should more or less happen. What the those who fought against buying the jet, what they now claim is that there is certainly not a majority to buy a jet from the United States, because there are security issues, political issues with the United States at hand, that they feel they would probably launch a new popular initiative if the government decided to buy either the F-35 or the Super Hornet. You can never say in Switzerland, nothing is decided until it's really decided. So I think there is a slight opportunity that there will be a new referendum, but most probably we're going to go ahead buying the jets. But this is only what this ballot meant for the jets. What it means for the army is a whole different topic, because, as you said, everybody in the army expected to win with a huge margin of 60-65%. And I think it must kind of, they must be asking themselves quite hard questions at the moment, why they lost that much of their support, of the support they used to have in Switzerland.
Well, we can dissect that on an upcoming Sunday. Let's just focus on the EU and this vote. Of course, it was, again, of course, limit-free movement. It was really to sort of roll back to where Switzerland was before. But some 60%, they voted in favor of not moving forward, status quo, and also, of course, entering into further discussions with Brussels. So not much of a surprise. But yet, at the same time, this has also meant, again, a bit of a moment of reckoning as well, I would imagine, for really the people's part of the SVP in Switzerland.
Absolutely. There is this kind of, the People's Party had this success in 2014 when they launched an initiative to take back control. It's quite similar to the discussion you had in the United Kingdom, take back control of the immigration. They won by a slight margin in 2014, and they now try to reinforce this win, and they failed quite astonishingly. So I think we're kind of back to normal after 6 years where immigration was a huge topic in Switzerland, where our future relationship was in peril with the United, with the European Union, where there wasn't quite, nobody was really sure, is there a majority for this custom-made bilateral approach that we've been following, or Switzerland has been following since the 90s. And but today I'd say there is a majority for free movement, for a free trade, for the status quo. But then the status quo will not carry on forever.
Indeed. Indeed. Christoph Lenz, we're going to have to leave it there. Christoph Lenz, political editor for the Tages-Anzeiger, joining us there from Bern. You are listening to Monocle 24. It's just gone 13:19 here in Zurich. We're going away for a short break. Back right after this. You're back with the briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. We're heading east now to Vienna. The Austrian capital is due to hold its municipal elections next month, and alongside the traditional issues of excessive traffic and the environment, there's a debate about who should be allowed to vote. This is because a third of Vienna's population don't have voting rights. Well, Monocle's Alexei Kolarov reports from the Austrian capital.
Despite the pandemic, the municipal polls in Vienna will go ahead next month. In fact, about 40% of voters have already registered to vote by post, and that number continues to rise. Unsurprisingly, the city's response to coronavirus is high up the election agenda. Besides that, voters are concerned about
a very broad range of issues, from traffic issues to environmental issues, working life, social issues like inclusion or discrimination.
This is Johanna Kuchling, one of the people behind Wahlkabine.at, a website that helps voters make up their mind.
It is an initiative existing since 2002, and we have been providing fact-based information on elections. So how it works is that users answer a list of 25 questions on current issues and can so find out how their personal opinions agree or disagree with the party's positions.
Johanna is not allowed to give me any information about the user's preferences, but she hopes that the website is making them aware of the smaller parties taking part.
Smaller and new parties do have it part in Austria, as they probably have it everywhere. So what our website does, and I think it's true that it does make it a bit easier for the topics and the issues and the questions that small parties might raise that the traditional parties do not care for that much. We show their opinions and their like party programs, for example, because who really reads party programs, you know?
Indeed, it is only the smaller parties, the brand new Links and the more established Greens, that have addressed perhaps the biggest political hot potato in Vienna.
I think it's a scandal that one third of the population who permanently lives here cannot vote. It is a huge democratic problem.
Austrian law severely limits the voting rights of non-Austrian and non-EU citizens. In Vienna, that makes about 500,000 people.
My name is Magdalena Stern, and I work for the human rights organization SOS Mitmensch, which is organizing the Passegal election this year for the fifth time already. Mm. So the Passegal election is an initiative or an election action, if you can say so, which can be roughly translated into vote whatever nationality, and draws attention to the exclusion of one third of Vienna's population from the Viennese city elections in October.
Mm. And has it always been the case? Has it always been a third of the population, or is it a recent development?
The number has doubled since 2002. The exclusion in Vienna has always been bigger than in the rest of Austria because Vienna is a city and a federal state. So in every other place in Austria, EU citizens have the right to vote in local elections. But in Vienna, they cannot because Vienna is a city and a federal state. So they are also excluded here.
Magdalena says this growing group of the disenfranchised is the result of a xenophobic immigration system.
Our naturalization rate is 0.7. For example, in Sweden, they have a naturalization rate of 8.2. We criticize that as well with our campaign. It is very hard to get Austrian citizenship. You have to have a minimum stay, a minimum income, and you have to have integrity and German skills. And the minimum income is so high that, for example, 60% of women workers in Austria could not fulfill it.
So, I mean, how realistic do you think? How real is it that a third of the population that currently does not have the vote can have this vote?
It's realistic that, for example, if parties who also want to change the immigration laws and make them more inclusive, get the majority, that is changed because you only need the majority in the parliament for that. If that would be changed, that would already be one big step in the right direction. So that people who actually want to have the Austrian citizenship and want voting rights are able to get it and are not excluded because of financial reasons.
The Social Democratic Party, which has ruled Vienna since 1945, is widely expected to remain in power. Like Austria's other big parties, it has always ignored the problem of the disenfranchised. Many of its members don't even see it as a problem. But sooner or later, the Vienna city government will have to deal with it. And better sooner than later. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you very much, Alexei. You're listening to Monocle 24. And finally for today's program, a little bit of culture, which means we're off to London to speak to our editor in charge of that beat. Chiara Ramella is there. Good afternoon, Chiara.
To you, Tyler.
We have a variety of things that you would like to cover. We've been talking a lot about art fairs. We can talk about some interesting news with Andrew Neil this morning and maybe yet another news channel for the Dial or also Team Lab as well. Many will be, of course, familiar with their work. They've got a new experiential art project. Where would you like to start?
Well, let's stick with Team Lab, shall we? So as readers of Monocle and plenty others will know, this is a multimedia collective that's based in Japan. And their artworks have become hugely popular across the world. And they've already got permanent sites in Tokyo. They've got already permanent sites in Shanghai. And they're going to be opening another one in the city, inside a nightclub, to be precise. Now, I think what's interesting about this is that in the last few months, we've had so many conversations about what the future of the gallery is going to look like and whether we're going to have to, go through single way pathways to visit, art galleries and as such. And there are obviously concerns and questions as to whether moving towards the experiential, as it was the case for much of the art museums around the world, is still going to be feasible. And, the adoption of these installations by Team Lab, by new, venues. And also there's still a hunger to still build new permanent sites for Team Lab. There are reports of, Utrecht and Jeddah also wanting a permanent site of their own. Seem to prove that there is still an appetite for bringing people together inside a gallery. Because I think the point is that every time you went to a gallery to see an artwork of this kind, it's not about, the mass presence and having rows and rows and rows of people queuing up to see the Mona Lisa, for example. But it's about an experience that is controlled so that you can still share it with people. But it's not about packing people in. It's about everyone being conscious of their surroundings and seeing also how the artwork plays off themselves and the people around them.
Mm. Should we just maybe spend a little bit of time? Of course, we've now seen that Art Basel Miami has been cancelled. We were talking to Mark Spiegler, the director, quite recently. But you've also just got something about just maybe some of the shifting currents that are also happening in the art fair business.
Indeed. So obviously, Art Basel, the main fair, occurred digitally. And it's interesting to see how that also has had to evolve in its format. And it has taken place in a more subdued digital format, I would say, in that only 100 galleries were taking place. Each gallery was only allowed to show 6 works, all of which had to be made in 2020. But moving forward, it's interesting to see that Art Basel is talking about its Hong Kong fair, in a physical format. And it's thinking about putting it on in the exhibition centre, in the convention centre in Hong Kong, but also together with Art Central, which would have taken place somewhere else in the city. It's interesting to see how different fairs are having to come together and collaborate and, also unlikely partnerships or partnerships that we wouldn't have not expected are having to come about because art fairs are shifting their role and shifting the way that they can operate to make it feasibly, not only practically, but also financially moving forward.
And Chiara, just quickly before we go, in about 45 seconds, news that Andrew Neil is looking, and Andrew Neil, of course, former editor at the Sunday Times, very much part of certainly the News Corp world for a long time, wants to set up his own channel now that it's been announced that he's leaving the BBC.
Indeed. So this is news that he's looking to launch GB News. It's going to be right-leaning and it's going to be modelled or at least reminiscent to many of the kind of Fox News beat. And I think what's interesting about this is that he says that this is going to serve that audience that doesn't feel met by the kind of output that the BBC is putting out. It's going to have to be impartial to the Ofcom standards, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have continuous kind of balance between the opinions that it shows. It just needs to show alternating viewpoints. What's interesting, I think, is that is an opinion-based channel going to work better than a news rolling channel? We seem to see that opinion-based channels do have very high ratings, and opinion-based coverage is cheaper to produce than news than rolling news. So whether this is a smart business investment and if it's going to actually get the traction that it wants, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see that also the head of BBC News reacting to this being in Italy, for the Pre-Italia, and also saying, also the BBC needs to be aware and maybe not listen to cancel culture so much as well. So it's kind of fascinating to see that the BBC knows that they are on watch and also maybe how they start to balance things on their own news desk. Chiara, we're going to have to leave it there. Our culture editor, Chiara Rimella, in London. That's all for today's edition of the programme. Our show is produced by Rhys James and Julian Goffin. Our studio manager, back in London, was Christy Evans. The Briefing, of course, is back at the same time tomorrow, 1300 Central European Time. Here in Zurich, I'm Tyler Berlay. Have a good afternoon.